Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, this week, Florida Democrats disavowed some controversial comments made by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, their party's current frontrunner in the presidential race. During an appearance on CBS's 60 Minutes, Sanders said that while he was opposed to Fidel Castro's authoritarian regime in Cuba, he believed that not everything the dictator did was bad.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
Sanders praised Castro's literacy and health care programs in Cuba, sparking outrage among Cuban exiles here in Florida. He made no mention of the firing squads, political purges, and mass arrests that accompanied Castro's 1959 revolution.
Now, Florida Democrats were quick to disavow Sanders' comments. The state party released a statement saying, quote, candidates need to understand our immigrant community's shared stories, end quote. What does this mean for the upcoming primary election here in Florida set for March 17th? If you support Bernie Sanders, do these comments change your opinion or maybe not matter to you? We want to know where you stand. We'll go to your calls and tweets in a moment. Call us up here now on the Florida Roundup statewide at 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. Democratic strategist Scott Arsenault joins us now with his thoughts. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Good to see you. So the state party condemned Sanders. In your view, how does this affect the Democrats' chances to win Florida and also other races that you're working on around the state on behalf of Democratic candidates?
Sure. And thanks so much for having me on today. It definitely has an impact. I mean, Florida is in the general election is going to be a 1% state, which means whenever you're losing any bit of vote from any area, you have to make that vote up somewhere else. And particularly in South Florida, where Miami, Dade, and Broward counties make up about 20% of the vote statewide, anytime we see any dip in our vote in that area, it can affect us statewide and cause us to lose the state.
Bernie Sanders has won Latino votes in other primary and caucus states, particularly Nevada. How is he going to do with the Latino vote in Florida, do you think, in the wake of these comments?
Well, Melissa, in the Florida campaign handbook, I think it's rule number three, don't praise Fidel Castro. I mean, this is not something that you do. It's not a good thing. So it's not a positive.
Well, let me ask you as well. There's even a lawsuit in Florida now asking that Senator Sanders not even be on the ballot in Florida. He's not a member of the Democratic Party. As a leading Democrat in the state, what are your thoughts about that lawsuit?
Well, I think the lawsuit is frivolous. The state party gets to set what the ballot is here. And I think it'll get tossed out. And I think that's a little extreme. I mean, this process, still early. Only three states have voted. We don't vote for another a little over 2 weeks. So this race is a long way to play out.
And let me ask you as well, Bernie Sanders, in the minds of millions of Americans, is a socialist. He would call his political philosophy social democrat or democratic socialism. As you work to turn out Democratic votes, is that a distinction without a difference, particularly for older Democrats? How are they reacting to all of this? What are you hearing?
Well, I certainly think there's a distinction. Let me be clear. And what I hear from Florida Democrats is that I'm a Democrat. This idea that you have to have an explainer to go along with it, that's not really where Florida Democrats are. How that's going to affect the election, I think that still remains to be seen.
Meanwhile, let me ask you about election security in Florida, or maybe the lack of it. Of course, four counties were hacked here in 2016. This week, we learned that the state forced all 67 county election supervisors to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, before they could get their federal funding for elections security, even get hooked up to the state's voter registration system. How concerned are you that voters won't have confidence in the security of the process this fall and also in the March primary?
Well, I'm very concerned. And it is outrageous that in the Sunshine State, we have no sunshine with regard to our election security. I mean, the public needs to know what we are doing to make sure our elections are secure. And frankly, to hear things like, oh, we have an NDA and can't talk about it, that's just not good enough. We know there's problems out there. We know there's things to be done. and people have a right to know what they're doing. And let's frankly hope, Melissa, that they're doing something. That's my, I think the scariest thing is that they might not be doing anything.
Well, we'll continue to follow it and speak with election security experts, and we want your calls here on the Florida Roundup. It's 305-995-1800, and Tom, already getting tweets.
We are, as a matter of fact. One tweet from Austin Orr saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but throughout Castro's rule, many democratically elected leaders have acknowledged the significant social and health reforms brought by the Castro regime, and Sanders has denounced Castro's many atrocities along the way. Let's put this to Andy Gomez. He's professor emeritus of Cuban studies at the University of Miami and the author of the book Social Challenges Facing Cuba. Andy, welcome back to Public Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
What do you make of Austin Orr's tweet there? Correct me if I'm wrong, but throughout Castro's rule, many democratically elected leaders, he writes, have acknowledged the significant social and health reforms brought on by the Castro regime.
And I think we have to put it into very clear, you know, a position here. I mean, the issue here is how Senator Sanders phrased his comment. Let's go back to that, the tweet, and to your question. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama got many votes from the Cuban-American community in South Florida because of some of the positions, not only that they took in reference to Cuba, but also in terms of domestic and foreign policy for the United States. If you really want to rally the Cuban-American community, all you need to do is say something positive about Fidel Castro. Now, having said that, Cuba's literacy rate in 1950 was already one of the highest of all Latin America. No question, in 1959, when Fidel Castro came into power, the Afro-Cubans and the rural farmers really were socially in the bottom of Cuban social economic standards. Many of them did not know how to read and write, and Castro did build more schools and clinics to give these individuals access to education and to health care. However, the issue here that we all have to keep in mind is, what was the strategy behind all of this? The strategy behind all of this from an education point of view was to use it, particularly in the schools, K through 12 and higher education, to begin an indoctrination process to Marxist ideology. And I have to tell you, they did it very effectively.
Andy, let me ask you about today's electoral makeup in Florida, in which these comments by the senator have been inserted into. The Latino voting population in Florida is much different compared to the Latino populations we've seen vote, especially in Nevada, and we will see vote in California and Texas. How do you describe that, first of all, that lack of a monolithic Latino population here?
Well, let's begin with the Cuban-American vote. The Cuban-American vote traditionally has been Republican. That has changed. And why has it changed? The majority of the Cuban-American community today came to the United States after 1990. So they come with a different mentality. As a matter of fact, those that have become U.S. citizens have registered as independent. We've also have seen in the last 20 years more Cuban-Americans register as Democrats. So it's not necessarily a straight Republican ticket, but now you see people that I think have matured politically in the U.S. system begin to look at issues not as they refer to Cuba, but how do they apply to our adopted country now, the United States? How do they impact us?
And I want to ask you about that because Cubans have been the dominant Latino voting group in Florida, hundreds of thousands. But now that population of eligible voters is rivaled by Puerto Rican voters, especially
or Venezuelans.
Venezuelans are growing, but not to the level of Cuban Americans or Puerto Ricans. So how has that affected political messaging?
The Puerto Ricans in general have been more registered as Democrats. And we've seen, of course, a majority of that concentration after the hurricane and after their economic woes on the island concentrate around the Orlando area precisely. The Venezuelans now are going through, I would call, the experience that the early wave of Cuban Americans did back in the 1960s. However, many of them are still not U.S. citizens. But the Cuban Americans are the smallest growing Latino population now in South Florida. We have them from all over Latin America. As a matter of fact, I call Miami the capital of Latin America, per se, as you know.
You're not the only one to do that, Andy. Andy Gomez is professor emeritus of Cuban studies at the University of Miami, author of Social Challenges Facing Cuba. Andy, hold on the line. We've got a lot of folks commenting about Senator Sanders' comments regarding Fidel Castro and the Castro regime that brought a lot of attention, obviously, to that Florida Latino vote. 305-995-1800 is the phone number. 305-995-1800.
Lots of tweets coming into the show. Here's just one. 20 years ago, I would have agreed with all this, but Cubans aren't the only Latinos in Florida today. We want to know what you think. As Tom just gave the number, let's go to some calls, beginning with Janine in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Janine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I think this is a really important and interesting issue and question that you raised from Bernie Sanders' comment. I heard it live, and I knew the kind of response we'd get. But I think, too, is it's an opportunity to have a leadership conversation about issues that involve everyone. I did not hear him embrace the atrocities of Fidel Castro. That's not at all what I heard. And I think instead of polarizing, and even here in South Florida, nobody in this community thinks that Cubans are all the other Latinos. So the messaging is very different. But I think reaching out on a human level, trying to find a common thread that joins us all, which is literacy, health concerns, those kind of things. That's how I interpret
it. So, Janine, do you know who will get your vote, Janine? Who will get your vote?
You know what? I am still undecided and listening very intently. I'm currently living in Spain. And although I'm joining you from Fort Lauderdale today, I do find it interesting what we are coining socialism. I don't think that's what people think of when they think of Europe. But, you know, that's the difference we're seeing. I see a difference in the population there.
Okay, sure. Yeah. And sure, Janine, certainly there's a different view in European countries. And I appreciate your thoughts about this. Scott Arsenault, there you have an undecided voter. But she didn't necessarily react negatively to Senator Sanders' comments. We're also getting lots of tweets about this, and the majority of them are supportive of Bernie Sanders. Here's just one. I was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. I was an independent, but changed my registration to Democrat so I can vote in the primary for Bernie. Castro's comments are not an issue for me. Twitter is not a representative sample of the whole state, though. But what are your thoughts about the feedback we're getting right now?
Well, I think statewide, sure. If you're in North Florida or maybe Tampa, it's not as big an issue. But I think we do need to realize that for folks, particularly in South Florida, who are coming from countries of conflict, Venezuela, as we mentioned, we talk about Colombia, you can talk about the same thing, Nicaragua, we haven't mentioned, who are all now coming into South Florida, this is a big issue for folks. Many of them are only one generation away from having had to leave a country that had this dictatorship or this kind of upheaval. So for the folks who it is an issue for, it is a huge issue. So we need to acknowledge that. And, you know, hopefully this is an opportunity that maybe we can pivot to a discussion of what is our relationship with Cuba. Do we go back to more of an Obama approach of trying to open up dialogue with Cuba, open up an embassy like he did, you know, and have that kind of discussion? Or do we go to a strict embargo like Trump has done? Maybe that, hopefully this helps us pivot to some that kind of discussion as opposed to, well, who's praising who? That's what will help us.
Yeah, and it does play differently. Certainly even just the question of embargo or engagement plays differently with different populations, of course. Andy Gomez, it does bring up the issue, and the caller kind of alluded to this a little bit, about socialism and this term socialism and how it is heard differently in different households, different communities, different regions, certainly of the United States. One tweet here, I haven't been a Bernie supporter, but at least he tries to speak his truth. If a felon does something good, it's okay to say so. Same with Castro and a member of another party. There's questions about this the generational divide around socialism, and how does that play with the diverse Hispanic Latino community in Florida and elsewhere?
Well, you know, we have to be very careful, as we all know, because as one of your earlier callers said, socialism or social democrats in Europe is very different than when we speak of socialism or the left in Latin America. So you can't put them all in the same context to a great extent. I mean, the problem that Bernie Sanders runs into, particularly in South Florida, is because this was not the first time that he has made reference to Cuba or Fidel Castro in a way that has pushed a passion, what I call a passion button, among Cuban Americans. Of course he's entitled to his opinion. And having spent all of my life in education, what more do I want than having 100% of our country be completely literate? However, an example, you can be completely literate in Cuba, but you don't have access to all the books as we have in a free state, like a United States. So, you know, what are students being allowed to read and see? And I have to tell you from first experience, I have many of those books that I have collected over the years. And for small children in kindergarten, first grade, to begin to learn the alphabet by reciting the ABCs, F is for Fidel, C is for Che Guevara, you begin to think, you know, where's
that's,
this whole
that's
thing
going? Indoctrination. Yeah, if I could, let me get another call in. It's Dan in Ocean Ridge. Dan, go ahead quickly. We're close to a break, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I wanted to comment. I agree with many of the people who have talked already, but the Anderson Cooper interview was about an interview that Bernie Sanders did almost 30 years ago with what appeared to be a student reporter asking, well, why didn't the Cuban people rise up against Castro if he was such a bad guy? And he was trying to explain to them that, and I don't think it's been talked about enough, what was there before Castro? He wasn't, the United States of America and our corporate people here installed a failed politician living in South Florida, Batista, in 1952, to run Cuba. For the next 7 years, over 20,000 Cubans were killed to keep that. American companies under Batista owned all the cattle ranching, all the mining, much of the oil drilling, almost all the arable land. Many Cubans had to live on sugar cane and grass, with the other gentleman just mentioned about
sure. And Dan, sure. There's been a long and troubled history in Cuba. But that said, it sounds as though you're taking the senator's comments in stride. Fair to say?
It's not as being lost here as the United States, especially Republican Party, but others who have pushed the interest of corporate interest above all else.
I hear you. Okay, and that's Dan in Ocean Ridge, and we want to keep the calls coming here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800. Lots of tweets as we talk about the front runner in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders. How will his comments about Cuba play here in Florida in the March 17th primary? Let us know your thoughts. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. A quick break, and we'll be right back with some more of what you have to say from wherever you are in the state. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about the Democratic presidential frontrunner Bernie Sanders and his comments regarding Fidel Castro and Cuba and other Latin America dictatorships that he made earlier this week, both on 60 Minutes on CBS on Sunday and then also during the Democratic debate. 305-995-1800 is the phone number, 305-995-1800. Andy Gomez is professor emeritus of Cuban Studies at the University of Miami, author of Social Challenges Facing Cuba. And Scott Arsenault is along with us, a Democratic strategist. Scott, we received this tweet regarding the conversation around socialism and democratic socialism from iPolitic Global is the handle of this Twitter account. Let's stop being scared of socialism, it writes. American public schools, law enforcement, police, libraries are all socialist institutions we love. There are bad socialist countries just like there are bad capitalist ones. How is the Democratic Party engaging with this term socialist or even democratic socialist, especially when it comes to Florida and the importance of Florida Democratic voters?
Well, sure. And I want to be clear, like the socialism attack, and that's what it is. It's an attack. Republicans are going to use it as a pejorative. They previewed this in 2018. I worked on Andrew Gillum's race, and they came out in 2018 without context and without, frankly, any facts and just and called him a socialist. They're going to do that with Democrats really across the country, and we'll certainly see it here in Florida. And again, it's without proof, it's without evidence, and it's because they know that it's a word that scares people. It's part of their scare tactics.
But what do you mean that there's no proof, no evidence? The senator himself describes him as a democratic socialist.
Well, it's frankly all the other candidates. Andrew Gillum did not describe himself as a democratic socialist, yet they called him a socialist. They're going to use this with every candidate. If Bernie Sanders did not exist, this attack would still be there. That's what I think we need to realize as Democrats.
So you're saying if someone else gets the presidential nomination, Republicans will use this line of attack. However, the front runner is the only candidate in the race who is a self-described social democrat or democratic socialist. So in your view, does that threaten perhaps the Democrats' control of the House of Representatives going beyond Florida issues? Some national Democratic leaders have said they're concerned about that.
Right. It is going to make it difficult. You're absolutely. We need to acknowledge that the majority probably of our candidates are not going to be in lockstep with our nominee. That hasn't always been that way in the past. And they're going to need to be able to differentiate themselves from where Bernie Sanders may be on certain issues. I mean, that is something we will need to come to grips with.
305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup is the Twitter handle. Giancarlo is with us in Orlando. Giancarlo, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for having me. I called because I want to say as a 24-year-old living in Orlando, I'm very concerned about Bernie Sanders and his comments on Fidel Castro. His refusal to call Nicolas Maduro a dictator until in a debate early around November. And I'm very concerned about him because although he described himself as a democratic socialism and he has extraordinary programs that I like, there are other candidates like Elizabeth Warren that also have these programs and are not trying to alienate the whole country in this concept, in this idea of socialism. And this idea, I'm using the word revolution. Mm-hmm. As a Venezuelan who immigrated to the U.S. because of a revolution, this word is very, very scary to me. I'm here for a Democratic candidate. I would say I'm anyone but Bernie, including Trump. I don't want Trump to be the president, especially because of the climate change and of the crisis of our country. But if it comes to Bernie or Trump, it will be Trump for me.
Giancarlo, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Andy Gomez, what do you think there from a 24-year-old student? We've seen the youth vote in early primary and caucus states tend to bend toward the Sanders campaign.
Well, you know, I'm hearing that from many of my former students as well that started to call me after Senator Sanders made his comments, latest comments, I should say, in 16 minutes. But let's reverse it a little bit in order to put this even to further context. Isn't it wonderful that in a free democratic society, we can have candidates, whether you agree or disagree with them, say what they think? Now, keep in mind, if this were to happen in Cuba today, as it happens with every day with opposition and dissidents that oppose the regime in Cuba under now Miguel Díaz-Canel and controlled by Raúl Castro, what are the consequences for those people? They get thrown in jail.
Yeah.
They get thrown in jail or they disappear. Has happened.
Andy, you know? I'd like both you and Scott to respond to this comment on Twitter we received from Mark. Mark writes, how long will Florida as well as the nation be held hostage by the Cayocho crowd, 8th Street? This is a reference to Little Havana, a neighborhood
I don't think anymore.
Historically,
I don't think that's true anymore.
Cubans settled.
I don't think that's true anymore.
I'll tell you what. Scott, are Democratic operatives like yourself playing into old thinking? Has the ground shifted in our politics enough so that that kind of mindset might not hold sway this election?
Well, the ground is certainly shifting. That's clear. And I think you see the movement you see with Senator Sanders is evidence of that. But look, it's also shifting, we discussed earlier, the fact that we have literally thousands of Puerto Ricans coming here off the island almost every month into Florida. More so last year, it sloughed off a little bit. The fact that we've got this great influx from Latin America who is coming here, that's the change. That's the ground that is changing. So what's really has changed, as we talked about earlier, is the percentage of the Cuban population that makes up the Hispanics in Florida has shrunk and will continue to shrink. So that means things change overnight. But that's a different thing than the older guard in Little Havana. Sure, that's getting smaller. But are we going to basically react to that? Sure, but that doesn't change some of the fundamentals that we've been talking about. That praising Fidel Castro doesn't bring you positive.
You still think
here.
That's a net negative for Florida?
That's typically a net negative in Florida. I feel pretty comfortable with
no
that.
No question.
It also, one of those fundamental questions is turnout. That Cuban American vote in South Florida has been a reliable turnout for the Republican Party majority going back, what, a generation, Andy, I think?
Yes.
You know, President George W. Bush won that vote with an enormous margin.
But take a look at how many Cubans voted for Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, which had not voted Democrats before. So there's, as Scott is saying, there's a generational. The historicals, my parents' generation is smaller or have disappeared. My generation, born in Cuba and grown in the United States and proud to call myself an American, Cuban-American, our mentality, our way of thinking politically is also very different. And then you have my daughters and my son-in-laws who tend to be more open in, when it comes to issues dealing with Cuba. Mm-hmm. It's not that important. It's not that important. The economy, health, I mean, all those issues are more important than a candidate's position on Cuba.
Yeah, and I think a difference from 20 years ago is that the Democratic Party, we will actively compete for Cuban votes that we weren't doing.
Yes.
We weren't able to do that 15, 20 years ago.
Correct.
And that allows us to be in a position, I think, this year to win the Hispanic vote statewide with close to 60%. When just in 2010, when Rick Scott and Alex Sinkett, it was split 50-50.
Including if Bernie Sanders is the nominee.
I think including if.
You think with him as well.
Hmm. Quite the prediction. Well, less than 3 weeks from presidential preference primary here in Florida. Scott Arsenault, thanks so much for coming back on the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you again.
Thank you.
He's a Democratic strategist who joined us from Jacksonville. Andy Gomez via FaceTime. Andy's the professor emeritus of Cuban studies at the University of Miami and the author of Social Challenges Facing Cuba. Andy, thanks for your time as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
About the treatment of kids in Florida. It follows a couple of incidents. One was the arrest of a 6-year-old girl with special needs in Jacksonville. The school said the child was acting out of control, but when the sheriff's cruiser arrived, that's not what officers found.
I don't want to go to the police.
You don't want to?
No, please.
You have to.
Now, this child was taken to a mental health center and held for 2 days. She was detained under the Baker Act, a Florida law allowing emergency mental health services and the temporary detention of someone who can't make decisions for themselves. The Florida Times Union says this child was given antipsychotic meds without her mom's consent. Also this week, body cam footage was released from another incident that happened a few months ago in Orlando. A police officer there has been fired after he arrested a 6-year-old girl, arrested her, and zip-tied her wrists after she threw a tantrum at school. The incident drew widespread and worldwide condemnation.
And it certainly has sparked a lot of conversations around law enforcement and the use of Baker acting when it comes to Florida kids. Reporters Megan Reeves and Jack Evans of the Tampa Bay Times have reported extensively about children and the Baker Act. Both of them join us from the Tampa Bay Times newsroom. Megan, what did your research find in terms of the usage of this Baker Act in regards to children in Florida?
Sure. So our research was really focused in on schools. The state does keep data just generally on how many students are fall under the Baker Act, how many children fall under the Baker Act in just in general. But it doesn't tell us where they come from. So we did know the most recent data shows that in 2017-18, 36,000 students, children across the state were placed under the Baker Act, and that works out to about 100 every day. So Jack and I really wanted to kind of drill in and try to find out where those kids were being taken under the Baker Act from in our own community. So we looked at the four counties in the Tampa Bay region, and we basically went to law enforcement and just said, can you tell us every time that you've responded to a school for a Baker Act? Mm-hmm. And we found that in the last 7 years, that's happened 7,500 times just in our four counties.
And what, Jack, did you find in terms of how these were being initiated or why they were being initiated? What led to the calls?
Well, that's a complicated question and a complicated answer, and I might let Megan pitch in on this too, if that's okay with you guys. But kind of, we've found things across the board, and some things that didn't surprise us, and some things that did. You know, going through, we reviewed hundreds of police incident reports that describe how the Baker Act happens in schools. Some of them are very cut and dry things. A student expresses suicidal thoughts, says, I'm going to go home and hurt myself, something like that. The Baker Act is used so that child can get some help. And that's what the law is there for. There are also absolutely incidents that fall into gray areas or wrongful uses of the Baker Act. And these are things like very young children throwing tantrums and a police officer is called in and initiates the Baker Act, or a child with autism, having some kind of behavior that is normal for that child might even be reflected in that child's IEP, which describes, how that child typically behaves.
And IEP is the Instructional Education Plan.
It's an individualized education.
Individual plan. Is the I. Thank you.
Right, yes. Right. Sorry. And, might even be reflected in there, and yet, an officer makes the decision to place that child under the Baker Act.
So it's really a mixed bag, how these things unfold. And I think it's important to note, too, that even though we reviewed so many of these police reports, some of them just simply don't say why a child was Baker Acted. It just says that they were. And that's really the most fulsome record of that incident. And that's part of the problem that we think we found in our reporting.
And we can say that, at least in our area, in these reports that we reviewed, the vast majority of the time, the person making the decision to use the Baker Act was not a mental health expert with, advanced degrees and years of training on this. It was a police officer or a sheriff's deputy who might have gotten, 40 hours of training on the subject, if they're lucky, but is certainly not an expert.
Megan and Jack, hold on. Megan Reeves, Jack Evans with us, reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. They have reported on the increasing use of the Baker Act in Florida as it relates to Florida kids. Perhaps you have an experience with the Baker Act. 305-995-1800. We're going to take your phone calls in just a few moments. 305-995-1800.
Well, let's bring in Dr. Angela Mann. She's a professor and licensed psychologist. Mann is with the Center for Children's Rights, Children's Advocacy Collaborative based in Jacksonville. Dr. Mann, your organization has called for reform of the Baker Act in Florida, and you've looked at the critical shortage of mental health providers in schools and their ability to deal with kids in crisis, kids who are acting out, kids who are suffering. What is at the heart of this issue?
I really think that there are multiple things that were pointed out in that Tampa Bay Times report that really highlight the need for reform. So one being that often, as was the case with the recent incident in Jacksonville, parents aren't notified that their child is being transported for evaluation until after it's already been completed. And so that's certainly one of the things that we believe needs to change. Parents should really be notified at the outset before the child's even transported from the school.
Seems like common sense.
Yeah, it does. I also think that several of the issues that have already been mentioned around data. So right now, it's really unclear to us if threat assessments are being conducted, formal threat assessments, when these Baker Acts are being initiated, and if formal suicide assessments have been conducted. And so it's unclear at this time the reasons, the specific reasons for why students are being Baker Acted from schools, and it's difficult to identify patterns.
At the root of this, too, is your data shows more kids are suffering from mental illness, depression, suicidal thoughts, right?
Absolutely. So we know that 1 in 5 youth will struggle with mental and behavioral health. And the vast majority of those students are going to be receiving services in schools, although we still know that very few students are really able to access the kind of comprehensive services they need. And so the other end of this reform is really that we need more comprehensive mental and behavioral health treatment.
That's really the story, isn't it?
It is.
The entire state, kids and adults, are crying out for better access to mental and behavioral health services.
Absolutely. So the students that tend to be Baker Acted multiple times, we know that often they're the students that are accessing services the least. And right now, what we see in schools is, ratios of students being served by school-based mental health professionals are well above national averages here in Florida. They're well above recommended ratios, in some cases 4 times the amount of students that we should be serving. And that's really tough, especially in a state that ranks last in per capita mental health spending.
Lots more to get into with this. We want your tweets here on the Florida Roundup. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Calls to 305-995-1800. Reform to the state's Baker Act. Where do you stand on that? How do you think schools should deal with children who are acting out? How should the state make sure parents are involved in any process that begins? There is so much outrage over a few incidents, but there are systemic problems, as we're learning, that go deeper than the headlines that have driven a couple of those incidents. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio, and we will be right back with more about this.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue talking with Megan Reeves and Jack Evans of the Tampa Bay Times, they've been looking into the state's Baker Act and how it's used often with children, critics sometimes say inappropriately. Also with us, Dr. Angela Mann with the Center for Children's Rights in Jacksonville. And your calls. What do you think about the use of the Baker Act, particularly on kids in this state? 305-995-1800. Tommy is in St. Pete right now. Hey, Tommy, thanks for calling the Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts about all this?
I've got a child that is in the state system.
Okay.
Needless to say. And when she was at shelters and stuff, she would use the Baker Act in order to get alone time because there was surrounded by kids and stuff. And a lot of the people there at the shelters, they may not have the ability to help her out,
right,
even if they are trained in it. They kind of use it just as a safeguard so that she don't hurt herself or others, or it does happen and she comes back and says, oh, she hurt herself and we got warnings, but in all actuality, she just used it to get alone because the kids were picking on her or something like that. And she knows she can get her own room for the night and she'll be talking to people. She'll get attention, she may even get some drugs. Just depends, you know?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you explaining your family's situation. And I'm sorry you and your daughter have had to deal with this. Thank you for your call, Tommy. That's Tommy in St. Pete. So, Dr. Mann, hearing stories like this, I think what you will say is this calls for reform of the system when families in crisis are using the Baker Act essentially as a Band-Aid.
Right. Right. I mean, we've heard countless stories here locally of parents who are on wait lists for long periods of time trying to access mental and behavioral health care, and often kids ending up being Baker acted while they wait. We've also heard of stories of families who, after a Baker act or after their child being arrested, are actually giving up their rights to their child and the child ending up in the foster care system, which we know places them at further risk for these kinds of issues.
Let me bring back Megan Reeves and Jack Evans, reporters for the Tampa Bay Times. They've been both looking at the incidence of Baker acting in the Tampa Bay area. Megan and Jack, you heard Tommy's story in St. Pete. Lots of different reasons, right, behind any particular case of a Baker Act being exercised. What has your reporting found when it relates to children in Florida who are subject to the Baker Act about the reasons? In other words, is it danger to themselves? Is it a danger to others? What is it that's being exercised there?
So I want to point out that Jack and I solely focused on schools. So we didn't necessarily look into how children in general are being placed under the Baker Act, but specifically in schools. And I would agree, you know, that mental health services kind of intermediary are not as available in schools as I think that they probably should be. So I think the Baker Act has kind of become it should be something that's a last resort, but it's kind of become the only resort. It is something that Jack and I often say, because it just seems that those services are those intermediary services are not really available to kids. So you have teachers who, you know, they might get overwhelmed in their classroom. Like Jack said, there might be a student who has autism or another disability, and they have what they often call meltdowns. That's behavior that really is normal for them, and sometimes even coping mechanisms that are misunderstood by people who are not qualified in classrooms to help those children. And so then the reaction is immediately call an officer to the room. The officers, you know, their job, his or her job, is to protect that school and keep it safe. And so I think in that kind of split second decision, they're thinking, we need to get this child out of the classroom. They're disrupting the classroom. The Baker Act is a good solution.
Dr. Angela Mann, let me ask you quickly, too. Your organization, Center for Children's Rights, has connected misuse of the Baker Act with the school-to-prison pipeline in some cases, because the data shows overwhelmingly kids of color are more likely to be taken out of school, detained, or as we saw in that really controversial incident in Orlando, a six-year-old girl was arrested. She was not Baker Acted, though. But how, in your view, would reform of the Baker Act address this other issue, the school-to-prison pipeline, where kids, primarily kids of color, are pushed out of school and into the criminal justice system?
I think there is concern that as Florida received lots of criticism for, at one point, several years ago, leading the country in the school-to-prison pipeline, that schools may have been seeking other ways to push kids out. And in this case, Baker Acting data is not reported to the Florida Department of Education. And so there is a real concern that this is being misused and that it's becoming the new way to push kids out of school. We see that after incidents like Parkland, we saw, you know, pretty large increases in Baker Acts, around 10%. And our most recent data from the Department of Juvenile Justice indicates that school-based arrests have also increased by 10%. And this is while we see significant declines in community-based arrests, more use of civil citations. And so it does seem like there is kind of generally a culture at this point of concern about youth behavior, and that's leading to a push out in schools, largely because, as the reporters have already mentioned, there really is a lack of comprehensive services within schools to prevent these types of push outs.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Annie is online too from Tampa. Annie, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio now.
Hi, I first want to just thank Jack and Megan for bringing this to light, because this is a true epidemic going on in this area, and it really needs to be changed. My daughter is 15 years old. She has already been diagnosed with anxiety and takes daily medication. She went and spoke to her social worker after having a couple of anxiety attacks at school, just saying, do you think I need to have my medication changed? Again, that was all she asked. She didn't say anything about being depressed. She didn't say anything about suicide. She has no history of suicidal tendencies. She was Baker-acted. I had no idea where she was. I got to the place to where she was and found out she had been strip-searched. They wouldn't let me see her. They, you lose all of your parental rights. When I finally did get her back, she had to spend the night with a girl that I have no idea who it was. But the stories that she heard while she was there traumatized her so badly. She's in counseling now. And she also mentioned that she had to babysit a four-year-old in there. And this is a real, this is really happening. I couldn't believe this actually happened to my daughter. I don't let her sleep over at anyone's house, ever. I mean, I don't do that. And for that to happen to the point to where this horror story that she talks about in counseling, you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
This has to be changed. And I, and parents not being told where their kids are and what's going on and what's happening, it's outrageous.
Annie, I want to thank you for sharing your personal story. Megan and Jack with the Tampa Bay Times, what are the rules around parental or guardian notification when it comes to a Baker Act being exercised on a minor?
Well, at this point, we've found that in most of our area school districts, based on the hundreds of police reports that we've reviewed, in an overwhelming majority of cases, parents don't know that their kids are being Baker-acted until they're already on their way to a mental health facility or already there. And that's essentially baked into the policy in many of these school districts, although some school districts and law enforcement agencies, it's more informal than it is formalized. We spoke to some folks at the Hernando County Sheriff's Office who told us that their take on it is basically that calling a parent before a child is taken away from school, they think that it could actually make the situation worse, that a parent might show up to school angry and that they essentially don't want to deal with that. And they've told us that because of that, they prefer to not contact parents until the Baker Act is already put into place. That's kind of one of the explanations that we've gotten.
And I'll add that something that we've heard from parents, though, kind of on the other end, is that, you know, they have kind of pertinent information about their child. They know their child better than anyone. So say their child does have a disability, say no one has looked at their individualized education plan, that parent could have key information that could dictate, you know, or change what happens.
Sure. Angela Mann, what are your final thoughts about this as the legislature is looking at this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've made some gains over the years in terms of the recent mental health allocation for schools. But certainly we need more comprehensive mental health services, and they need to be preventative. I mean, we're really talking about the crisis end of services when we know that most of these Baker Acts could have been prevented to begin with. And so I hope that we focus our efforts there on top of the reform that's already been mentioned here, notifying parents ahead of time, collecting better data around the types of threats. That's,
one person is collecting it now, right?
Right.
The Baker Act Reporting Center, right. One individual.
It's one individual, and then there are seven, she has a team of people who help her with these reports. But, you know, thankfully last year the legislature required that more frequent reports be made about youth who are being Baker Acted. But again, the data remains kind of unclear at this point.
We will continue to follow it. But, you know, it really is an incredible story that affects so many thousands of families all over Florida, Tom. You know, it's deeply emotional, and it touches schools, law enforcement, mental health, the law. This is something that is of vital interest to so many Florida residents.
It certainly is, and it's something that's gotten a lot more attention in the months and year or so after the Parkland tragedy. And Megan and Jack, just a couple of quick seconds here. Is there legislative focus on it in a real meaningful way, in your estimation?
There is. There have been bills this session filed in both the House and Senate.
Yeah.
I have not been keeping track necessarily every day on those, but I do know that the House bill, which is sponsored by Representative Jennifer Webb over here in Gulfport in our coverage area, does have backing from the House Education Committee.
Jack, we got to leave it there. Jack Evans, Megan Reeves with the Tampa Bay Times, and Dr. Angela Mann with the Center for Children's Rights. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks to our entire production crew as well. Been a great show. Thanks, Florida, for engaging on the phone and on Twitter, too.
Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers. Jason Zabka, the director of radio programming, and our technical director. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Theme music from Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend.